Good morning. We're studying the history of the world from the biblical perspective. I'm sure we all remember what that is. It's the view that history is a control process, and the controlling agency of history is the hand of God, who intervenes in all matters of history for his purposes. Now, the advantage of looking at history from that angle is that we see connecting links. We connect dots that otherwise we would not see, that they're hidden. And the verse we've been looking at the past several weeks is Matthew 5:14, where Jesus says, "You are the light of the world. A city set on a hill cannot be hidden." He's saying, believers are the lamp by which the light of God is projected out to the world. The light is the revelation of God to humanity. Specifically then, the light is the gospel, the good news that we can be saved, have eternal life, just by believing in Jesus Christ, the Son of God, who died on the cross for our sins. He said, "You are the light." And secondly, a city set on a hill cannot be hidden. The light won't be hidden. Whatever the condition of the light is, whatever the spiritual condition of the church is, that condition will be projected out into the culture around it. So if at a given time or a given church, in that area, in that church, the gospel is dim, the gospel is dark, or there's no gospel, well, that church will project something. It just won't project light. It'll cast a shadow of darkness out into the world around it. He's saying whatever condition believers are in, that will impact the world. And we've seen that the Dark Ages of Europe, which began about 600, lasted over 700 years, were produced by the dark church. On the other hand, if the light of the gospel is strong, that strong light will project strong light into the culture around it. We've been looking at Martin Luther, who 1517, put that as the date, rediscovered the gospel. Salvation by the cross, salvation by faith in Jesus. And that was a powerful light. Now, there's two ways to tell how powerful a given source of light is. One is, how many areas of culture does it impact? And secondly, how long does that influence last? All right, so if we want to measure how strong the light of Martin Luther was, it's strong on both counts. Because the light of Martin Luther extended through the Renaissance in the 1500s all the way through the Baroque era of the 1600s. That's a strong light of Martin Luther. In the 1500s, the Renaissance, we had in the field of literature people like John Milton, Shakespeare. In the field of art, we had Rembrandt, Michelangelo, Leonardo da Vinci. And that light of Martin Luther projected on into the 1600s, the Baroque era, and that's where we have the composers Handel and Bach. So that's how we know that light of Martin Luther was strong, lasted a long time, influenced every area of culture. But in time, human beings got involved. That always messes everything up. And that light began to dim. And by 1700, the church had deteriorated into cold, formal legalism. So God, remember, God, controlling agency of history, is God's hand. God's hand moved in to wake the church up, and he raised up John Wesley in England. John Wesley was born again in 1728, so we can put the year 1728 as a new church age, the church age of Philadelphia. That's the church that is the evangelical church, the missions church. And every evangelical church today, every missions-oriented church today, every church where they preach the gospel today is still a legacy of John Wesley. John Wesley's light led to the Great Awakening, and it did awake England. In fact, John Wesley pretty much single-handedly inoculated England from the turmoil that was happening over on the continent. French Revolution took place reached the peak in 1789. It never made it to England because they had been spiritually conditioned by John Wesley. The gospel saved England from the turmoil of Europe.
Did John Wesley start the Methodist Church?
Yes, he did. He started, there was already a Methodist Church. He founded the evangelical branch of it, we'd say. But he's really the father. The churches today that draw from John Wesley would be the Evangelical Methodists, the Wesleyan churches, actually the Nazarenes, the Assembly of Gods, all pretty much follow the legacy of John Wesley. Baptists do too, except in the sense that Baptists add eternal security for the believer, which some of the other denominations don't have. Well, that lie to John Wesley was powerful. It even influenced America through Wesley's friend, George Whitefield, who came to America and preached the gospel and befriended Benjamin Franklin. And the rest of their lives, they considered each other, or the other one, his best friend. Amazingly, Benjamin Franklin never became saved. Well, unless something happened on his deathbed, I read something he wrote 2 weeks before he died, and he clearly was not. But he admired Whitefield. And what Franklin saw was that when people started, when the way he looked at it, people started going to church, they became better people. He wasn't making the connection they were born again. They weren't better people, they were new people. All he saw was changes in people's lives. So he thought, well, that's a good thing to go to church. So he encouraged all the delegates, for example, to the Constitutional Convention to go to church to pray. So here's an unbeliever using the lie to John Wesley as a mirror and encouraging people to go to church and pray. And all that praying produced the American Constitution and the American government. Thank you, John Wesley. His lie was powerful. It extended to government, culture. And remember, another way to tell if someone's lying is powerful is how long it lasted. Well, the lie to John Wesley lasted a long time. On the cultural side, the lie to John Wesley extended through the 1700s, and that's the era called the Neoclassical era. 1700s, Neoclassical, and all the way into the 1800s, and that would be the era of Romanticism. I'm going to talk about both those today. 1700s, Neoclassical era. The 1800s would be the era of Romanticism, or the Romantic era. Let's begin with the Classical era. Sometimes I'll say Classical era, because that's what everybody says. Technically, it's the Neoclassical era. Because, technically, the Classical period of history was the time of ancient Greece and Rome. That was the Classical period. In the 1700s, in Europe and now America, and by the way, now when we start talking the 1700s, we're bringing in America, because for the first time, culture and the arts are flourishing in America. Where was I before I got off track? Rewind. In the 1700s, they revisited some of the themes from ancient Greece and Rome, specifically order, form, and control. That was feature of the old classical era. In the neoclassical era, it's revived. Order. That's the important word. If you want to get one key word for the neoclassical period, it's the word order. And we want to understand why people had the concept of order in the neoclassical era. And it's because Jesus said the light of believers will be projected out. That explains the neoclassical view of order. Because during this time, they believed in what's called the traditional worldview, the biblical worldview, and that is this. There is a higher being. That higher being is the source of right, wrong, true, false, good, bad. Now, there can be widely different opinions about who the higher being is and what right or wrong is. But the traditional worldview is a higher being is the source of that. That traditional worldview would last all the way until the age of modernism and postmodernism, which we'll be exploring beginning next time. But the traditional worldview is very simply summed up in Daniel 4:17. The Most High is ruler over the realm of mankind. Daniel 4:17 says the Most High is ruler over the realm of mankind. There's the traditional worldview. God rules. And now that worldview dominated the age of neoclassicism. And what's amazing is that worldview that led to order was held not just by believers. The traditional worldview permeated all that culture. And that worldview is reflected in architecture, art, music. I want to begin with architecture. See, remember the neoclassical era, they revisited the order of the culture found in ancient Greece and Rome. And here's the Parthenon, built about 400 B.C. in Athens. Now, that's the way it looks now. Looked a lot better then, trust me. Like Zsa Zsa. Look at the order and the form. columns, everything symmetrical. That architectural style was revisited during the age of neoclassicism in America by Thomas Jefferson, the president. And Thomas Jefferson was another one of those Renaissance men who was an architect, inventor, engineer. He designed his own house, Monticello. You see the connection? It's clearly based after classical architecture in the neoclassical era. And, of course, the French church, La Madeleine, built just after the time of Napoleon, had a classic example of neoclassical architecture. Not what you'd call a thriving evangelical church. Started during Napoleon's time and then abandoned, and then completed shortly after his death. It's a striking view from the Champs-Élysées when you turn north and look at it. It's so big, it looks like it's very close to you. It takes a while to get there.
I think they named it after a restaurant.
Yeah. Yes. They named it after the La Madeleine here in the Woodlands. Yes, yes, a known historical fact. That's architecture. And notice, see, everything is in order. But the reason this, and by the way, there's all kinds of buildings throughout Europe that were built during this period that have that same look, the columns and the order. But, and the reason is, it's not a mystery. It's because everybody had that traditional worldview. Everything is in order in the world, and it's reflected in their architecture. That's the light of the gospel. And it's reflected in architecture and also in music. And in music, in the neoclassical era, there are two preeminent composers. And it so happens they're both Austrian. One of them was Joseph Haydn, born 1732. And the other one was Wolfgang Mozart, who was born in 1756 and died in 1791. Yes, if you did the math quickly, he only lived to be 35 years old. But what an output. Mozart's compositions are masterpieces of order and form. So this order and form we saw in the columns and the architecture of the neoclassical era, we see that same order and form in Mozart's music. One of his most famous works is called Eine kleine Nachtmusik, a little night music. It's a very familiar song. Listen to it. Sure you all know it.
How's that?
Okay, that's a very familiar piece. Now, the reason that piece works so well, I'm going to play it back again, and I want you to notice something. Notice that the way he begins is, he repeats the same basic phrase. It's a 9-note phrase. Dun, 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 dun. Same phrase, but the second time he just changes the notes. He resolves it differently. And the whole piece, Eine kleine Nachtmusik, is it's repetition and variation. He'll have one phrase, the same number of notes, then he'll repeat the phrase and just change the notes. Listen again. Check for the 9-note theme. Da, 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 da. Well, there's the score in case you want to look at it. See, you can see it's a picture of order and form just by looking at the score, can't you? Dun, 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 dun. See, the same pattern repeated. Look at that. It looks like columns, doesn't it? In the score. Okay, now listen again. Then listen again. Dun, 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 dun. Anyway, you see the pattern. Order and form. That's classic neoclassical music. But it's because everybody had the traditional worldview. Believers or unbelievers, the art they produced unconsciously had the order and the form in it. So architecture, we find it. In music, we find it. And also in painting. We find the same order and form And all these painters of the neoclassical period had order and form. They weren't necessarily doing it on purpose. It's because they all shared this traditional worldview. And probably the preeminent painter of the neoclassical era was Jacques-Louis David, obviously French, born in 1748, and his paintings reflect neoclassical order. Here is his painting called Napoleon at the St. Bernard Pass. That's a picture of order in painting. Now what that means is, there have been enemies. And you can see the images back here that there has been some kind of a battle. In fact, it's commemorating France's victory over Austria in 1800. But you see, there have been enemies, but no problem, because Napoleon is in control. He has conquered them. And notice how all the lines in the painting point to Napoleon. The landscape back here, starting at the northwest of the painting, moves down to Napoleon. The horse's legs move to Napoleon. The few little lights in the sky lead to Napoleon. His own arm leads down to himself. Because of Napoleon, everything was in order. And also notice something different about the neoclassical era as composed to Renaissance and Baroque paintings we saw. In the Renaissance and Baroque, we saw strong contrast between light and dark. During the neoclassical period, we don't see that. Very little light and dark. And that's because in the neoclassical picture, there wasn't dark. Everything was light. Everything was in order. Everything was under control. There wasn't any dark. So in the neoclassical era, it's mostly light. Everything is in order. And even nature is under control in the neoclassical era. Look at that horse. He's totally under control. He's probably talking. Like Mr. Ed. What's really interesting is that Napoleon made this, he's crossing the Pyrenees here. Napoleon made that crossing in actual history riding a mule. But he told David, put me on a horse. Be a lot cooler looking. So he painted him on a horse. The horse totally under control. That's neoclassical era. A similar one is David's painting called The Coronation of Napoleon. That's a majestic work. We saw that at the Louvre. It's so big you can't imagine. It covers like a whole wall. It's an amazing painting, and it's a perfect example of neoclassical painting. One, you look at it, and all you see is order. Look at the columns. Everything is lined up right. All the people are in the right place. And did you notice? All the people are upright to match the columns. Order and form. There's one person who's not upright, and that's Napoleon, who's seated. He's about to get the crown, and someone bowing before him. He is seated because it's under control. He's conquered everything that needs to be conquered. And all the lines really lead to Napoleon. Look at the little bit of line on the people's faces points to him. The clothing points to him. The columns point to him. Of course, the crown points to him. This cross points down to him because he is God's representative. God appoints rulers. God brings order. And there's the classic example right there. Order and form. Probably David's most famous painting is one we all know. It's simply called Napoleon in His Study. That's the famous painting of him standing there with his hand in his vest. It's called Napoleon in His Study. I would have named it something different. I would have named it One Too Many Snickers. Actually, it's a masterpiece of order and form. Even his hand. His hand is in his vest, indicating rest. Everything's taken care of. Everything's in control. I'm just going to stand here calmly, put my hand in my vest. And notice the lines point to his hand. Even the upright columns point to his hand. The top of the desk points to him. The painting, or the whatever this engraving on the wall, points down to his hand. It's the center of the painting, meaning that's the point of control. He doesn't have his sword out. It's right over here. He doesn't need his sword because everything's conquered. His hand's in his vest. Order, peace, stability. That's the neoclassical picture. Order and form. And control. Even nature's under control. So, speaking of nature, In the neoclassical era, 1700s, people used to think of nature as being compatible with human beings. Like, nature is our friend, would be their slogan. Now, and that, you see, highlights the problem we see in the neoclassical era. I'm sure you already saw some of the problems here. And that is that in the neoclassical era, the view of the world was a little bit idealized, or greatly idealized. Because nature is not that way. Nature's not always with us. Nature's not always under control. So what happened? The age of neoclassicism, the music, the architecture, and the painting all tended to become somewhat cold. You look at a lot of paintings in the neoclassical era, and they start to become cold. And even the music. Now, Mozart and Haydn were blockbusters, but a lot of the music of the neoclassical era, it'll put you to sleep. Oh, it's in order, it's formed correctly, but not much beauty there. Became cold. But remember, that shouldn't surprise us. Because it corresponded to a coldness in the church at that time. The church had become cold and legalistic. So about the year 1800, people began to realize, wait a minute, that's not really the way the world is. Everything's not really in order. Everything's not really controlled. Nature's not really our friend. People started to catch on. That world out there is fallen. And once again, where did they get that thinking? From the Bible. Because the Bible presents a picture of nature as not being idealized, not under control, but fallen. Romans 8:20, for the creation was subjected to futility. Futility is a word that means things don't work out. Things are not under control. Things are not in order. Not willingly, but because of him who subjected it. Meaning nature didn't make itself fall. God brought nature down on purpose. You know why God did that? It was just after the fall. And Adam had fallen. And Adam and Eve were nowhere near the majestic beings they were before they fell. If they had continued on to live, with nature being unfallen, they would have had no chance against nature itself. They would have been overwhelmed by nature. So God had to lower the whole creation to give human beings the opportunity to exercise some dominion. So God brought nature down. So nature is not compatible with human beings. For example, that horse that Napoleon was on, horses aren't naturally under control. Horses have to be tamed. Go to a wild horse and say, come here, Trigger. He'll either run, or if he feels threatened, he'll kick you to death. He's not going to say, yes, sir, where do we want to go today? Nature's not under control. Now, that new way of thinking led to a new era, and that's the era of Romanticism, beginning in the 1800s. Now, the neoclassical era tended to become cold, whereas the age of Romanticism, now, that age stirred people's emotions, stirred people's imaginations. Romantic era is a wonderful era for all of culture. But it's very difficult to understand. I remember in school having a hard time getting a grasp on what Romanticism was. It's this, it's this, it's this. I couldn't get a clear picture. I've come to conclude there's no way anybody can possibly understand the era of Romanticism without understanding the biblical worldview. You see, the Romantic era was like the others. It influenced every era, painting, music, culture, literature, because everybody had the same worldview about nature, the biblical worldview. And the Bible paints a picture of nature that shows a tension in nature that was reflected in the era of Romanticism. Yes, there's a tension out there in nature. Romans 8:20, 21. Again, for the creation was subjected to futility, not willingly, but because of him who subjected it, in hope that, actually it means this, with the certain expectation that, not in hope, it's with the certain expectation that the creation itself also will be set free from its slavery to corruption, into the freedom the glory of the children of God. He said a mouthful there. Let me distill it down a little bit. He's saying this, that there is a tension in nature, out in the world of nature itself. Nature is indeed fallen. And yet, in some sense, nature itself has a clear expectation of being restored by a new birth. You may say it again? The Bible presents a tension in nature. And that is that nature is fallen. And yet, within nature, in a sense, there is a certain expectation that nature itself will be restored. And, now I'll add something, and that when nature is being restored will happen when we are. Now, we've already been restored spiritually, those of us who are born again by faith in Jesus. But we still carry around these fallen bodies. But there will be a time at the rapture when these bodies are glorified. They don't become weird looking and shiny and everything. They just become perfect. He's saying that will happen for us. And he says nature in some sense is anticipating when that will happen, so it won't be fallen anymore. It will be like us and glorified. Now, the key to understanding the Romantic era is that the Romantic era evokes our imagination, evokes our emotional response, because the artist of the Romantic era captured that tension that's in nature, and that is in us. The tension between the fallen nature of nature and this earnest expectation of being restored. There's the tension that is in nature, it's in us, and it was captured in the Romantic era. Romans 8:22, 8:29, that we know the whole creation groans and suffers the pains of childbirth till now. Romans 8:19. That was 8:22 I said. Here's 8:19. For the anxious longing, that means longing would be maybe so, maybe not, wouldn't it? It means for the anxious expectation of the creation waits eagerly for the revealing of the sons of God. Again, nature to some degree is watching us. He said, when he's restored, I will be too. Now that's degrees of understanding. The unbeliever, for example, he has a vague memory of paradise because every culture throughout the world has some idea of this paradise that was lost. I think it's in everybody's DNA that was passed down from Adam, who was created in the image and likeness of God. So in everybody's DNA is this vague memory of a time when nature was right, when there was paradise. And also, the unbeliever has a vague sense that the ideal state will come in the future. So that unbeliever out there, he's got a tension about nature. And we believers, there's a tension within us too, and it's probably even more powerful. Because we know the facts. We understand the difference. We know that nature is fallen. We know that our bodies are fallen. Our flesh is fallen. But we know that we are children of God. And when we are raptured, we will appear just like Jesus. So within us, there is that tension. I'm fallen now, but I'm going to be restored. There's a tension there within us. Even animals share that. In fact, Romans chapter 8, when Paul is saying that creation is groaning and looking to us, he's clearly talking specifically about the animals. I mean, rocks don't look at us longingly. Animals sure do. Animals, to some degree, know they're fallen. When I say to some degree, I don't know how they understand it. But the Bible says to some degree they understand it. And in some degree those animals are looking to us. And in some sense they know they'll be restored when we are. West Texas, I used to hear the howling of those wolves. And now I remember those and I'm thinking, now I know why they were howling. And doves. Doves have this gentle sound, that little cooing. It's gentle, but it's sort of mournful too, isn't it? Mourning doves, they're mourning their condition. And dogs, you ever had a dog just sigh? Well, ours does because she's so horribly mistreated. But now, the inanimate world, when Paul talks about nature, he's being metaphorical there. those rocks and trees aren't pining for them. But sometimes you hear that wind, and you think, that wind even sounds mournful, doesn't it? There's a tension out there, and you see that tension stirs our emotions, doesn't it? It stirs our imagination, and that's what the artist of the Romantic era captured. That's why it's so powerful. The tension we find in the era of Romanticism is within us. And it led to the Romantic era of art, music, literature. Now in music, that tension that we find in nature, what's the tension? Between its fallen state and this earnest expectation of being restored. That tension in nature is manifested in music in a very specific way, by a combination of dissonance and resolution. See, in nature we have fallenness, ultimate restoration. In music, we have dissonance and resolution. By dissonance, I mean a clash of notes. Notes that sound like they don't belong together, because they don't. Like, if you had any music lessons, picture hearing a G against an F sharp. They clash. So in neoclassical music, they would have these dissonances, but then faithfully resolve them. Dissonance, resolution. Dissonance, resolution. Pulling at our emotions, evoking an emotional response from us. And that's why the composers of the Romantic era are some of the most famous of all the composers. And it's the composers of the Romantic era that are the ones that are most likely that we know, the most likely to draw our emotions. And that's because they're tapping into that tension that we feel within us, our fallen nature, the expectation of restoration. Here's just some of the names of the composers of the Romantic era. Mahler, Rossini, who wrote the Barber of Seville, Chopin, Liszt, Johann Strauss, the waltzes, Mendelssohn, Brahms, Tchaikovsky, see all the great names, Wagner, all those great names from the Romantic era. If you want a piece of music that will rip your heart out, listen to Tchaikovsky's Symphony No. 6. It will keep having the dissonance and then keep resolving it over and over. I tell you, it'll tear your heart out. All of them are famous, all because they resonate with us, because they stir our emotions, because they're tapping into a tension we have that's real. Probably, or maybe, the preeminent composer of the Romantic era is Ludwig van Beethoven, born in 1770. Powerful-looking person, wasn't he? And he was a powerful composer. Actually, he was born in 1770. He died in 1827. Interesting years. Born in the 1700s, died in the 1800s. So he was actually a bridge between the neoclassical era and the Romantic era. Not just chronologically. He was a bridge in his themes. Because Beethoven was a master of combining the strict order and form of the neoclassicism with the Romantic era of tension and resolution. And that's why Beethoven's works have power and beauty. Because what a combination. Strict order and form, and yet the beauty of this tension and resolution. And probably the most famous of all of Mozart's works is the Symphony No. 5 in C minor, Beethoven's Fifth Symphony. That is maybe the masterpiece of order and tension and resolution. We all know it. Maybe the most famous four notes in all of music history. Everybody knows that. You know, as though he's building that on motif of four notes that's repeated. There's the preface. It started with four notes, but do you see he keeps doing four notes? Can you count those fours? Hear that? Okay. Get the point? He starts with four notes. And the rest of that preface is just four notes over and over. But, and so you're thinking a secret about this. You talk about order and form. At the beginning of it, what's amazing is every instrument is playing the same note. It's unheard of in a symphony. They're all playing G, 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 E flat. There's no chordal background of any kind. There's no harmony. G, 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 E flat. That's the first four notes. Every instrument playing the same. That's a pretty sparse looking score, isn't it? In fact, that score doesn't account for the power of the music we just heard, does it? Because it's a masterpiece. I'll show you why. Now, the four notes at the very beginning, dun, 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 G, 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 E flat. Now, we know it's called the Symphony No. 5 in C minor. However, we don't know the title. Those four notes, G, 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 E flat, are a paradox right at the very beginning. And that's because there's no chord attached to them. So that could be an E-flat major chord. It could be a C-minor chord. It could be E-flat diminished. It could be a G diminished. You just don't know. Now, unconsciously, you may not know all these musical connotations, but I assure you, when all of us hear dun-dun-dun-dun, that sets up an ominous wondering about us. What is that, doesn't it? Even if you don't know the techniques. Beethoven himself commented on that opening, and he said, "Thus fate knocks at the door." Dun, 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 dun. He did it on purpose. But what is the fate? Somebody's knocking on the door, but what's he selling? What's he saying? Who's at the door? So at the very beginning of that piece, it's strictly order and form, but at the very beginning, Beethoven, he draws in our emotions and our imagination and tension. There's a tension there. And then throughout the four movements of the piece, Beethoven masterfully takes the same four-note motif, da-ta-ta-ta. It couldn't be simpler. But then, through four movements, he explores those four notes with different rhythms, different tempos, different chordal backgrounds. And what he's doing is, through those four movements, he's exploring every possible way those four notes can be resolved. Now, we may not know what he's doing musically, but unconsciously, we keep hearing that same four notes, and we keep hearing it in different contexts. So we know what he's doing, unconsciously maybe. We know he's exploring every possible way it can be resolved. And he keeps hinting, "I'll resolve it this way." "No, I'll resolve it this way." "I'll resolve it this way." He draws in our emotions. He draws us in because of that tension. Now, as we keep listening, he will restore it. And he restores it in the third movement. I'm going to play the third movement here. He starts to resolve it in the third movement. In the third movement, he resolves it, and it's very emotionally satisfying to us. But what he does, he will revisit that same four-note motif, but this time it's not ambiguous like it was at the beginning. It's a majestic repetition of the four notes, da-da-da-da, da-da-da-da, and it's in a major key, meaning it's positive, meaning the guy who knocked at the door, he brought good news. Here it is. Watch for the four notes. There we go. See how he did it? See what he did with your emotions? You see how he started with the four-note motif? Develops it all the way through and ends with a majestic ta-ta-ta-ta, the same four notes. That's why I say it's a masterpiece of the structure and order of the neoclassical era with the imagination and the emotional response of the Romantic era. But again, let me point out, the reason that works with us is because the tension that he developed and resolved is a picture of he's tapped into what's happening within us. We feel the tension of our fallen state with the expectation we'll be glorified. That taps in with his musical presentation of those dissonances and resolutions. And that's why it's so emotionally satisfying. And that's why those composers of the Romantic era, we are drawn to them. Also, we find the neoclassical influence in painting. And now, for the first time, we have culture flourishing in America. And in America, the preeminent neoclassical painter was John Trumbull, born in 1756, a couple of decades, about 20 years before the Revolution.
And in Trumbull, we see the same pattern of tension and resolution we find in all the neoclassical artists. Here's Trumbull's painting, General George Washington at Trenton in 1792 during the war. And let me back up and say, Trumbull was a very credible person to paint a lot of paintings from this era because he was an actual soldier in the Revolutionary Army. Now you see, here's classical, neoclassical painting, because it's obvious there has been a battle. He's got his sword. There has been a battle, but it's over. It's all been resolved. No problem. Here's Trumbull's painting, The Surrender of Lord Cornwallis. See, there has been a battle. See, the winds are blowing. There has been a battle. There's enemies over there. But the title of the painting alone means everything's been restored. The tension's been resolved. The surrender of Lord Cornwallis. The word surrender alone means there was a war, there was tension, and now it's resolved. The ultimate irony here is that Trumbull was getting a gig in Lord Cornwallis because he called it the surrender of Lord Cornwallis, but that's not Lord Cornwallis. Cornwallis wimped out, claimed he was sick, and sent one of his peasants. And of course, Trumbull's masterpiece is one we all know, simply called the Declaration of Independence. The ultimate end of the tension of the war, everything is resolved. So we see it in architecture, music, painting, and in literature, we find the same pattern, tension resolution. Let me just throw out a few, because some of the famous artists of literature are also in the Romantic era. For example, George Gordon. George Gordon, also known as what? As who? He was Lord Byron. Lord Byron is a perfect picture of the poetry Romantic era. She walks in beauty like the night. You know that one, don't you? She walks in beauty like the night of cloudless climes and starry skies. Perfect Romantic poet. Because he's talking about this woman he loves, and he's setting her in the foreground against the background of nature. Cloudless climes and starry skies. Starry sky is a sky where there's no moon because it's dark. See, he sets her against that world of nature. Percy Shelley wrote Ode to the West Wind. See, the Romantic era, they bring in nature. But a tension, the west wind howls, there's tension in nature. Or what about Percy Shelley's wife? Mary Shelley, who wrote Frankenstein. Oh, what a romantic novel. What a fallen nature. What a fallen world. Fallen man. And the way it's resolved. Talk about a novel that evokes our imagination and emotions. Elizabeth Barrett Browning, a romantic poet. One of my favorites is William Blake. And my favorite poem of his is Tiger, Tiger, Burning Bright in the Forest of the Night. Perfect romantic poet. Because, you see, in the forests of the night, he's setting this beautiful tiger against a background of nature, but it's at night. It's not an idealized world. It's the forest of the night. And what a brilliant poet. You read William Blake, notice how he uses the end of lines to rhyme. Notice what William Blake always rhymes. That's why he's a haunting poet. He rhymed bright and night. Two contrasting themes, but he makes them rhyme. Something is shining bright in the night. There's a supernatural element. So Blake asks, what immortal hand or eye could frame thy fearful symmetry? By the way, did you catch on that symmetry and eye rhymed during that time? I want to talk about one more artist, and that is Thomas Cole. Thomas Cole was an American painter, I guess the first great American painter. He founded what's called the Hudson River School. And he's very famous for a series of paintings he did, all called The Voyage of Life. So it's one series of paintings called The Voyage of Life with four paintings. They treat a human being on the river of life as he grows from a child to old age. And it's very American because all the scenes in these paintings are taken from the early 19th century American wilderness. So Thomas Cole and the Hudson River School were the first artists to paint American scenes. And it's American forest, so it's American nature. See, he's a romantic painter. One thing to notice is it's a human being four stages of his life. And as we look at these four paintings, I want you to notice they trace the development in how people view nature. They trace the development of nature is our friend in the neoclassical era to nature is in tension and fallen in the romantic era. Here's the first one. It's just called Childhood. And one pattern to notice, with every painting, the boat's going a different direction. But all of them are a river of life. Here's a human being, and he has a guardian angel here. See? So here's the river of life. Here's the little baby. Here's the child, and here's his guardian angel hovering over him. That is really a neoclassical painting. How do we know? Because everything is in order. The guardian angel's in control. Here's the light from heaven. Here's the light of the guardian angel. See the connection? So here's the light of heaven. Here's the light on the angel, meaning this child is being guided by the higher being. And nature is friendly. See all the little pretty flowers? The water is totally calm, and the sky is very friendly. So that's a neoclassical worldview. Second painting is called Youth. He's a little bit older. And now it looks a little bit... Notice now he's going the other direction. Before he was going this way. Now he's going this way. Changing circumstances of life. But here in childhood, we see some differences. A little transition. He still has a guardian angel, but he's not in the boat with him. There's a little bit of separation. So there's a little bit of separation now between the child and the heavenly light, isn't there? Used to be the light, guardian angel, child right here. Now we have the light separated over here, the guardian angel, and light here in heaven, guardian angel, and here's the young person, and a little bit of a distance there, a little bit of separation from the heavenly realm. And a little bit of change. Now the water, a little bit murky, just a little bit. See? And maybe just a hint that nature is not totally our friend. A little transition here. Third painting is called Manhood. Now he's going back the other direction. Changing circumstances in life. Now this is manhood. This is maturity. This is real life. Because now you don't find the guardian angel. He's nowhere to be seen. This man is on his own now in the river of life. And what about nature? Well, now nature's not our friend. That water looks threatening ahead of him, doesn't it? Water's murky and dark back here, and ahead he's got rocks and rapids up here. That's the real river of life. And where's the guardian angel? You don't see him. The best thing to do is pray, hope. Hope there's some help. But it's not certainty. Right? And the sky. Does the sky look friendly and pleasant? Is the sky our pal there? No. The sky looks threatening, foreboding. And that tension that we see in that painting. This is a romantic painting now. That tension that we see is reflected within us. We know nature's fallen. We know we're fallen. But we anticipate we'll be glorified. And nature anticipates that all that tension will be resolved. And in the fourth painting, it's all resolved. It's called Old Age. Now he's back going the other way. Now the guardian angel reappears. And that's good news. And he's got other angels here. And see the light of his angel. The angel coming for them, and the light of heaven, there's a clear connection. But what a contrast. Now this is another great romantic painting because we have the darkness of the world here. Nature is fallen, right? Nature is fallen. Heaven is not fallen. Don't worry about that tension. Don't try to get better. Reach out to heaven. That's how the tension is resolved, by being glorified. And there's the anticipation that this light streaming down here will continue to flood the darkness. See that? So he's setting up the pattern for that's going to be the ultimate resolution when nature's restored, when we are restored. Now I tell you, there's some bad theology here. There's clearly the painter had no concept of the gospel. So let me just point out to anybody looking at these paintings when I post them online, is that you're not going to get to heaven by following your guardian angel or by doing good works. The only way we fallen people can go to heaven and have the light of heaven is to be born again by trusting in Jesus, not by depending on angels. Well, that's the romantic era. It resonates within us because it mirrors the tension within us and within nature. Gospel, and you see, one thing that I realized, As you look at this long era, two eras really, the neoclassical era, the romantic era, what powerful representations in art, music, literature. It's so powerful I even hear it still. What amazes me is we cannot lose sight of the fact that everything I've just presented, the powerful art, music, literature, was because the gospel had permeated those cultures. It had permeated the culture of Europe and America. The gospel really produced all that. The gospel has power within itself to do all that. But that should alarm us. If the gospel itself can influence a whole continent, can influence culture, the gospel itself can influence all of Europe, all of America, it can force itself into architecture, into music, painting, literature, even to unbelieving artists. And that influence can last a long time. If that's the power of that gospel, shouldn't that gospel have the same kind of power in our lives? And I mean just the gospel. I don't mean the gospel plus Bible study plus prayer plus all these Christian disciplines. I'm saying if the gospel can do that out in the world, shouldn't the gospel do it to us? Let me go and answer the question. The answer is yes, it should. And I believe what's happening is, I believe the church today is starving because of a lack of gospel. And I believe we in our own lives, we believers, are suffering because we don't have enough gospel in our lives. Paul was aware of that. Paul kept telling the Roman church, I wanted to come see you. I had something so urgent I had to tell you. This was a church of believers already. And he said, I wanted to go this time, but that happened. I wanted to go this time, but that happened. I've got to tell you something urgent. You think, what is it he had to go tell those believers in Rome? Finally, he says, here's what I want to teach, what I want to tell you, Romans 1:15. I'm eager to preach the gospel to you who are in Rome. They were already saved. He said, I can't wait to get there. I got to preach the gospel to you. And they were already saved. He knew the gospel had power for people who are already believers. Romans 1:16 says, I'm not ashamed of the gospel. That's a terrible translation. It doesn't mean ashamed. It means I do not underestimate the gospel. I think we do. It's the power of God for salvation to everyone who believes. Notice he says everyone. He is not just saying that the gospel is the power to save somebody who was an unbeliever. He is saying the gospel has power to everyone who continues to believe. In fact, the word salvation there, it means deliverance. Now, most of the time we see the word salvation in the New Testament, it is talking about the ultimate deliverance, which is from having to go to hell. However, he is saying that for everyone who continues to have faith in the gospel has that same power to deliver us. From what? Well, from the cold darkness of life, from the tension of living in a fallen world with a fallen body but with a glorified spirit. He says the gospel has power alone to deliver you from that. I believe we underestimate the gospel. Quickly, in Luke 4:18, Jesus says what the gospel is supposed to do to us. He says, the Spirit of the Lord is upon me because He has anointed me. Look at the list here. One, to preach the gospel to the poor. That poor is the same word as Sermon on the Mount. Spiritually bankrupt, meaning no resources. All right, you ever feel like you're going through life with no spiritual resources to deal with things? Well, I do all the time. You know what that means? We're deficient in the gospel. He said the gospel does that. To heal the brokenhearted, that means depressed. Now, it does not mean that something's wrong if something happens bad and we're depressed. If something happens that's bad and you're not depressed, you're a lunatic. Trust me. You can correct me if I'm wrong from the psychiatric approach, but I would say if something happens that's bad and you're not depressed, something's wrong with you, right? Did you buy that?
Yeah.
Okay. I'm talking about chronic depression that you can't find a reason for. You ever have that? Depression, you can't find any reason for it. That's brokenhearted. You know what causes that? We have a deficiency of the gospel. Or if we have a deficiency of the gospel, we can look forward to being depressed. To proclaim liberty to the captives. That means paralyzed from doing what's right. I believe most Christians are paralyzed by one of two things. Either procrastination or perfectionism. I think Christians go between both of those. We put things off because we're in a fallen world and we dread dealing with it. Or we are perfectionists, and it gets very frustrating because we can't do what's perfect. So we don't get things done at all. And we don't realize we're in a fallen world. We can't do things perfectly. Now, if we're trapped in one of those two modes, you know what diagnosis is? We're deficient in the gospel. He said the gospel gives liberty from that. And recovery of sight to the blind. We can't see what to do. Too many times we have areas of darkness. Now, many times God has brought those areas of darkness. I'm talking about when we walk around through life like Mr. Magoo, not just oblivious, like space shots, space cadets. When we do that, you know what's happened? We got a deficiency of the gospel. To set at liberty those who are oppressed. Oppressed means squeezed in, boxed in, crushed in. No way out. If you tend to have that pattern all the time, we're deficient in the gospel. You see, we underestimate what the gospel does. One problem is, I think, we tend to misunderstand something that Paul said. 1 Corinthians 3:1-2, he said, I could not speak to you as men, but as children. I gave you milk to drink, not solid food. For you're not yet able to receive it. He says, I just gave you milk. You couldn't handle solid food. But then Peter says in 1 Peter 2:2, like newborn babies long for the pure milk of the word, so that by it you may grow in respect to salvation. So one place, Paul says, all I could just give you milk. You couldn't handle me. And then Peter says, I'd love that milk. It's not really a contradiction, but it's a paradox. You see, I think we tend to get the mistake that there are meat passages and there are milk passages. Or reverse it. There are easy passages and those are milk passages. And there are hard passages, those are the meat. Like John 3:16, that's just milk. Hebrews 6, that's meat. Actually, no. No. There's no such thing as milk or meat passages. It's all meat. Peter and Paul are actually saying the same thing. They're saying, take those passages that look like milk and make them meat. That's how we meditate on the gospel. That's how the gospel becomes powerful in our lives. John 3:16. That's milk, pure milk. But here's how to make it meat. For God so loved the world. We say, well, that's God's basic predisposition to the world. Not looking to judge, but looking to love. And then we say, and that was the way God looked at me before I was saved. He already loved me. It's not that I had to make him love me. He loved me before I was saved. And his love drove him to do something, to give his only son. And all I had to do was believe in him and not perish, but have eternal life. I'll close with one more verse. I skipped it, actually. Let's go back to 2 Timothy 1:10. Our Savior, Christ Jesus, who abolished death and brought life and immortality to light through the gospel. Those aren't two different things. Those are two different things. Immortality means eternal life. Life, before that, means life now. How do we have that? Through the gospel. All right, we've gone a long time throughout our study of history. Believe it or not, next week we will move into the 20th century. Father, again, we thank you for this picture that you have given us, that you quote in Matthew 5:14, where Jesus said that we are the light of the world, and whatever that light is will not be hidden. It will impact the culture. Father, we thank you for how that gospel has worked throughout the centuries in all these different art forms. Above all, we thank you that that same gospel that can transform entire continents, entire cultures, if we let it, if we meditate on your word, on your gospel, how we've been saved just by faith alone, what power that gospel would have in our lives. And certainly above all, we thank you for Jesus, whose death on the cross is the gospel, is the good news for those of us who believe in him, and we thank you in his name. Amen.